heads up, everybody, this is recorded before the midterms. So if there's any takes that we have that are hilariously out of place because something shocking has happened during the midterms, then that's why. Yes. Just so everybody knows. And also, I'm barely functioning.
Me too. I'm still very hungover.
Yeah. It turns out that either...
I need to just kick the shit out of both of you then, because I'm feeling fine.
Yeah, no, Jen and I should not be in Vegas together. It's just a bad idea.
Yeah.
And by the way, there's a possibility that the First in the Nation caucus and the Super Bowl are going to be in the same city in the same week, that city being Las Vegas. And if Jen and I are there, one or both or subsequent other people might die. Like there's like a serious chance of bodily harm because we are dangerous night extenders. We both have dangerous night extension tendencies.
I appreciate you sharing the responsibility, but let's be honest about this here. I was the one being party monster. I'm the one who decided to dance until 2:30 in the morning with four kids from Tijuana, and you went to bed like a normal person. So I was the problem.
No. Well, I mean, I'm not saying that you weren't a problem. Obviously you were. Yeah.
I have now been out with Jen multiple times where Jen will literally befriend drunken foreign nationals in order to extend the evening.
Yeah.
Or will continue drinking in my camper while I'm asleep.
I didn't do that alone.
No, there were other people there.
I did have friends.
I mean, like, Jen, I love you. If you ever need to drink quietly and cry in my camper, you're welcome to it. But no, it was a moment of intense frivolity with multiple people. And I tapped out around 2 a.m. Yeah. It was like, hey, party camper, everybody hang out in there. I'm going to go to bed.
I love the middle of the night. I think it's just such a magical time. It's where you make real friends. I just think it's part of the fun of drinking for me is that I get to stay up late with.
So what were the name of your friends that you met at the Center Bar of New York, New York?
This was not a name situation. This was like, they are playing Selena. Let's go. It was fun.
It was Selena. Selena got the party popping.
That's what started it. But they were just really fun. I think they appreciated that there was someone in Vegas willing to hang out with them despite the language barrier. I knew enough words to say hello and welcome. And then we just danced together. It was really fun. So that's what I did.
I fell asleep in my clothes.
Yes, you did. I fell asleep with a double cheeseburger right next to my head that I didn't actually eat.
I am simultaneously really sorry and really glad that I missed out on this.
I'm
sorry that I missed out on that moment. I'm very happy that I'm not here with you for this moment being hungover.
Yeah, well, I just put a really great burrito on it, so I'm actually feeling the best I've felt in days. But I could use some sleep.
Well, that's the way to get the energy going. From Austin, Texas, I'm Justin Robert Young.
I'm Jennifer Briney.
And I'm a sober, feeling good, Andrew Heaton.
And we're not wrong on this edition of the program. We are going to talk about a new pay range transparency law in New York City and whether or not it is a bundle of unintended consequences. And we're going to talk lottery. There may or may not be a gigantic, damn near billion-dollar Powerball winner by the time that you are listening to this, but as we are speaking to you now, it still remains at large, and we're going to talk about, you know, the lotteries in general, whether or not they're good or bad for society. And of course, we hear from you all. Let's just get into this story here with the New York City pay range standards. As companies are publishing pay details for job openings under a law in New York City, some are listing maximum pay figures that are more than double the minimum pay for the job, and then stretching salary ranges to hundreds of thousands of dollars for certain careers. For example, a trauma surgeon in the Mount Sinai Health System could earn anywhere between $384,000 to $800,000, says a hospital's job ad. And a tax executive at PricewaterhouseCooper could make $158,000 or nearly triple that. The reason why we're talking about it is because this month, New York City became the biggest job market in the United States to require employers to list pay ranges in job ads. Supporters of the laws hoped that the rules would give workers an edge in pay negotiations that historically have left employers with most of the leverage. Economists and lawmakers predicted that New York's law, the ones that are set to go into effect in California and Washington state in the coming months, would reduce pay disparities, across employee populations, jobs, and industries. But this has frustrated many applicants, as a pay range that goes for hundreds of thousands of dollars does not particularly narrow down much of anything. And so we ask, is this a classic case of unintended consequences, or is the law well-intentioned and simply needs a few tweaks? Andrew Heaton.
This is a stupid law. I'm not going to go so much on the unintended consequences thing, because it doesn't seem to me that there's been a deleterious outcome from this yet. It's been a whiff. So like unintended consequences, in my estimation, tend to be a situation where a well-intended law causes all sorts of bad things. I don't know that this is causing things. I think that this is just a stupid law. And the reason I say that is page two stuff, like the Heaton government doctrine is this: you can give incentives to a company. You can't demand intention from them. No government in the history of mankind had the ability to go, we've decided you have to care about X from now on. It has to be a value that you ingest and that you motivate yourself by. They cannot do that. All governments can do is say, we're going to give you subsidies if you do the thing we want, or we're going to punish you if you don't do the thing we want. And you have to be very specific with that, because what they're going to do is whatever was motivating them previously, which is exactly what's happening right here. I think the lawmakers that were behind this in New York City wanted to effectively say the following: companies, from now on, you have to care more about the negotiating ability of the people that sit across from you in a job interview. You have to care about that. We want you to give them a bone. But you can't tell companies what they should care about. You can only give them dictums like this, which is exactly what's happened, is they've gone, oh, we have to put out a pay range, will make it ridiculously large. This is not surprising to me. And I can also tell you what's going to happen next. What's going to happen next is the New York City Council will lower the window on this. And they'll say, from now on, the estimate has to be,
you can only be within $100,000, or $50,000, or $25,000.
What the companies will all do then is just start lowballing you. They're just going to go, they're going to take that same spectrum and they're going to lower it to the low end of it. And people that come in, they're going to go, they'll either give them the lower price, or they'll say, come in for this job, and if you do a good job in a couple of years, we'll give you a senior thing, wink, wink, nudge, nudge. But this kind of thing, I think, is useless. There are examples where New York State has, or New York State in this instance has stepped in, where I think that they've been effective in terms of helping people in terms of labor. About 6 years ago, New York State made it a law that in a job interview process, you cannot, you, the employer, cannot ask a prospective employee what they're currently making or what they made at their last job. I don't mind that. That seems to me that that's putting the thumb on the scale a little bit in terms of the employee. Employers do have much more power than the employee. That kind of law is a lot harder to mess up. But this law, where you're trying to sort of force transparency in order to get the corporation to give more benefits to the prospective employee, I am not surprised that this is not working.
So I don't really agree with that. I think the ranges are ridiculous, but I'm just kind of looking back to my own experience as the worker who was looking for really kind of any job and being very frustrated with not even having any kind of idea of what pay they were looking for. So I found that I had to go through the initial steps with a company of like, reaching out to them, submitting my shit. Like, there was a whole lot of work that was on my end just to find out that like, this was not something I was willing to do. So I think when you look at the ranges, the upper ranges mean nothing to me, but the minimum one, that would actually be really, really useful, because if I'm looking at a list and there's a job that's like 40,000 to 400,000 or 150,000 to, you know, whatever amount, if I'm looking at those minimums, like, that's really informative to me. It tells me that like, this is not going to be a low ball, or like, I'm willing to start with this salary. So it's like the range part, that's why I think it's kind of weird. But having employers have to, from the beginning, give some kind of number. As a worker, I think it really will help people, because I think time is the most valuable resource that we have. So I appreciate the amount of time that would have been saved for me to have those numbers somewhere.
So here's my question. Is this not a problem that's already been solved by Glassdoor.com, which collects every, a lot of the companies that we just listed here? They are on Glassdoor.com. You can look up the various different positions for which you would be applying for, and you could see what people who have had those jobs at this certain experience level has been paid for them, and find out whether or not Todd, the office manager, is a dick, because usually Glassdoor is a lot of backbiting and sniping and stuff like that.
Well, so that's exactly the thing. The Glassdoor is the bitching forum for the people that no longer want to work there. So as useful as I do think it is that you get to see their numbers, I do think the company itself saying this is what we pay is important. So I like having both of those resources available, one from the former employees and one from the company itself. So no, I don't think this is a problem that's already been solved.
Well, I mean, I would suspect that the crazy different ranges are not necessarily even the company saying, we're willing to pay anywhere from 300 to a million. I think it's them trying to avoid, and we do not know what the penalties are, or at least I have not in my research, know what the penalties are for this, but I suspect that there are penalties for lying about the pay range and having your pay range or what you eventually pay somebody go either wildly over or under what you have publicly listed. And so that's the reason why we're getting these one size fits all. This is what we would pay somebody from an entry level to a senior position if you're coming in with more experience.
But again, that minimum is really useful. That's really what I'm looking at, because if you're saying that you're willing to pay between 100 and 800,000, and then you come at me with like, oh, we're willing to pay you 40, it'd be like, you put online that this was the range. So even though it is a wide, not net, but they have a lot of leeway there with what they actually offer, I think there's power in having that minimum somewhere in writing before the relationship even begins between worker and employer. I like it. But I do find the range thing interesting in general, because one of my biggest political rages has been the way that the politicians use ranges in reporting their stock trades, where they're allowed to be like, I bought between $1,000 and $50,000 of this stock. Like, it is a tool of the oligarchs to like hide their financial intentions. So I get what you mean by that. But that minimum number, there's power in that for the workers.
To have it be legally actionable, because that's the reason why you have a law, is that if you run afoul of it, then there is some kind of consequence to it.
Yeah,
I can see that.
Yeah,
I see there being value in minimal numbers. I'm just kind of looking at the range itself and thinking it's ridiculous. I can see there being used to having an anchor point there. I guess the thing that I could foresee situations where maybe they put $50,000 minimum, and somebody would be willing to do $48,000, and then that person just doesn't get hired or something like that. It's possible that that could occur, but I don't know. I think that this is largely a neutral whiff. But if having a minimum tether price is useful, I don't think it's a huge negative element.
Yeah, just saves me time as a job shopper.
Yeah, which, especially in some of these white collar jobs, people might be on the hunt. The word on the street is that Meta doing massive layoffs this week. In fact, one of the things that we were talking about in Vegas was Elon firing half of Twitter is a clarion trumpet call for every other company in Silicon Valley to fire anywhere under 50% of their entire staff. Because now that he's got the bad guy reputation of, oh my God, look how reckless. Now Meta can fire 30% of their staff. They can fire 10%. They can fire 20% and be like, well, I mean, this was just tinkering. This is responsible way to run your business, now that Elon has gone and cut half of them.
Well, there's also the internal problems with Meta too. They went all in on this stupid ass metaverse thing that none of us want a part of. And so that whole team is just like, okay, you gotta go.
Well, I mean, the larger problem with Meta is that they're a advertising company, and advertising has fallen off a cliff. And that's the same problem with television networks, newspapers, Twitter, Google, Facebook, are that advertising is in a very, very weird place right now. And Facebook kind of, they played themselves, because their greatest advantage was that they had a walled garden for which an advertiser could find exactly the person that they wanted to find and get their ad right in front of them at a certain time frame. That is a promise for which no other platform could give you. And then the wrong people won elections, and there was a lot of conversation about, hey, you know that the Russians can, you know, find exactly the kind of people that they want, and they can buy ads on Facebook for it. It's like, yeah, how do you think you bought that outdoor hot tub you only used once? Like, it's the exact same thing. And so with Cambridge Analytica, they turned off a lot of those super, super, super granular things. And, you know, now their advertising has gotten softer. And then Apple kicked them in the nuts because they allowed people to not track you on your phone as a default. Yeah. So whenever you open, when you updated your OS, if you have an iPhone, it just says, do you want to be tracked by this? And a lot of people were like, no, I will, in a binary decision, I'm going to go with zero instead of one. And that has been hugely wrecking to Facebook's financial outlook.
Yeah.
So I'll swing for government transparency for a minute.
Yeah.
I tend to be, so in today's instance, I just think that this is fairly ineffective because of the ranges. But a lot of the time I do think the government has a interest and a positive one in terms of compliance with transparency. Cass Sunstein, back when he was the head of OIRA, made it a point to require major appliances to show both how much wattage they would use annually and how much that would cost over 5 to 10 years. So if you were purchasing a refrigerator, and I believe this is still the law, you're required to show this is how much the electricity from this refrigerator will cost over a period of 10 years.
Yeah, it's on the Energy Star stickers.
Yeah, and I like that. I think that does help consumers make rational choices. I want businesses to be competing on merit rather than trickery. So the reason that's important with refrigerators is there might be a refrigerator that costs theoretically $200, but it is really, really low energy efficiency. So you end up paying more in terms of electricity bills. So that kind of government transparency allows people to go, oh, I'm going to put $400 down and not lose as much money. I like that we have calories in place on snacks, things like that. I think that's useful.
I
do wish that they'd quit bothering with a whole serving thing. I find that irritating. I'd rather just tell me I'm going to eat the whole fucking bag anyway. So just tell me how many calories in it.
I agree. I think it really is. That is, I don't know what lobbyists got a Christmas ham for carving that out to say like, well, it's 98 calories, but there's 50,000 serving sizes in this bag of M&Ms.
That goes back to my earlier point. You can't go to these companies and go, by the way, you have to care about whether people are fat from now on. You can't do that. All you can say is, we're requiring you to display the calorie count. And I'd rather than just do the calories, me go, oh, if it's 800 calories, half a bag is 400. That said, I find those to be helpful. So where the government is able to effectively compel transparency that lets people make informed decisions, I'm in favor of it.
You want to know a thing a bartender told me? I have no idea if this is real. And so any beer people, please email in to the show. But the ABVs on beer are wildly inaccurate.
Really?
And that they are often listed as less than what they are because that makes them, unless they are marketing themselves as like a super double IPA, drink one and you're going to fall down, like kind of thing. People don't necessarily want to buy a six pack of something that is going to be higher alcohol by volume. But that like a 6% beer very often can be 7 or 8.
So is there a range? Is that the issue?
No, it's a proving thing where initially when you get tested, like by whatever body does this, and this is, again, I'm remembering a half, you know, fuzzy conversation I once had with a bartender in East Austin, but they go through a process once and then past that, the formula can kind of change and be tinkered with over time. But much in the same way, you're allowed to have a little bit of rat shit in your factory processed foods because, you know, nobody's perfect. They're not going to hold you to it being higher, and nobody rechecks. Once you get certified for it, that's what you're certified for.
There are like whole corporate wars with lobbyists and things in terms of just defining labels for products. Like milk, according to the EPA, was for years a viscous oil. or something like that. Like it was this weird, I think it was the EPA. That's another one Cass Sunstein got changed. Like he came, OIRA, by the way, is the regulator of regulators. It's OIRA's job to try to get all of the regulators in the various agencies in the same state. There were things like that. There's also like the amount of trying to knock out other products by renaming them. So like coconut oil or coconut milk, sorry. It's like an old term, but like the dairy lobby will be like, no, it's not fucking milk. And will like go out and like do everything they can to require you to call it coconut spludge or coconut semen or whatever.
At Costco. Like, cause I always, I wind up, I'm the guy who likes to go to Costco. And so I'll always buy stuff for my wife who's calling me right now. And they have a wide variety of non-dairy milk-like beverages, but they are all called like non-dairy drink. Right. It's like coconut non-dairy drink, soy non-dairy drink.
Were we talking about pink margarine the other day? Was that you two?
No.
I can't even remember who this was. Margarine got so demonized back in the day where, cause like margarine, I don't know a lot about cooking here, but it's plant-based, right? It's like plant oil extract as opposed to butter.
I believe so.
It's
yeah.
Bullshit butter.
Bullshit
it's
butter.
Not real.
So butter. Like for a while it was, if I'm not mistaken, it was law that it had to be made gray. Like the butter, like butter companies like were like made of gray and then they made them pink. And you could not call it butter substitute or alternate butter or vegetable butter. You had to call it something, which is why I can't believe it's not butter.
I was going
to
ask. Yeah. They wound up using the porn parody loophole. Yeah.
And my understanding is that margarine's actually now today pretty healthy compared to regular butter, but it's been so demonized that there's all sorts of things that have been changed.
So I actually think because it's so processed and because it's not like I've heard that just you should just use butter.
I have no idea about that. I just think it's funny that there was an effort to make it gray at one point and then an effort to make it pink.
To make
at one
it look
dairy lobby swings a big stick in DC. That is a big lobby. So I would not be shocked that people on the other end of that
don't
are not
piss
having
off
a good time.
Big cow.
Big udder. Just squirting that cash on a Capitol Hill. On this edition of our Patreon Extra, you guys will get to hear our conversation about Elon Musk saying outright that you should vote for the Republicans in the midterms. Is it him putting his thumb on the scale? Is it free speech? We chop it all up for you, the paying public.
Patreon.com/We're Not Wrong. By the way, over 500 patrons.
Thank you on so this much, program. You guys.
We only started doing this in May.
Yeah. This is really, I can't wait to quit my other job. This is really gaining on the political orphanage. If it goes at the current rate, I'll retire in 8 years. It's going to be terrific.
Well, I'll tell you what, folks, if you like it, and certainly you guys are showing us with your money, then spread the word. Tell a friend. Let them know that this is a good show to be listening to as we enter in to the chaos that is the 2024 political season that starts in late 2022.
I'm already exhausted by it.
We watched football, Heaton, yesterday, and it was my dream.
It was my dream,
which was like odd because I was like legally dead considering how hungover I was. But it was just nothing but a million different TVs in a sports bar in Vegas at the Park MGM. And it was football. And then when football was over, nothing but hyperbolic political ads.
Yeah. And they had the sound on the game too. So like you could hear them. So every time I heard, I'm like, you know, I start getting nauseous again. I'm like, I hate this stuff. And you look at Justin, it's just glee. Like if this is an act, he deserves an Academy Award because he was so excited about those ads. No.
I live it. This is a lifestyle.
Did you see Game of Thrones?
No, I don't like violence.
Okay, there it is, right? So a lot of people will be like, oh my God, a horse got killed. And other people are like, yeah, Justin is the guy that enjoys the carnage.
There was one ad, which was Citizens for Sanity was the name of the group, the pack that put it on. It was directed at Nevada Latinos, and it was a Latina mother that was narrating it. And it started off as a little bit like kind of on the rails of like, you know, like the Democrats think that they can take advantage of us and what have they done for us? Nothing.
It started pretty standard.
Yeah. And then it's like the economy, inflation, we're trying to buy groceries and there's a sad abuela and she's like looking at a can and you're like, oh, okay, this makes sense. And then it's like, gets a little culture war-y. It's like, and now they're telling that boys can be girls and girls can be boys. And I'm like, okay.
Which is where I started to get the icks. I'm like, oh, this feels mean and dirty.
So yeah, but it's like, all right, you're trying to talk to a certain community that is a community that is going to blanch a little bit more. Everybody in the Latino community is not necessarily a gender studies major. So it's like, I get it. But then it goes totally off the rails as it's like, and Joe Biden has spent $900 kajillion on Ukraine. And it's like, well, that I don't know if the crew of construction workers sharing their canned micheladas at the end of the workday are talking about the Biden expenditures to Ukraine. But then the piece de resistance at the very end. And he's going to drive us to nuclear war. Big mushroom cloud. World War III. Yeah.
And Justin and I are sitting in this bar like, whoa, that took a turn.
I was like, this is the greatest day of my life.
Yeah, that, most people were watching the World Series at this time. He's watching the commercials and cheering for that.
Oh yeah, no, that was the night before. The reason why we were so hungover is that we were watching college football and I was just remarking, I'm watching like all the different TVs because it's another sports bar and there's like a bunch of college football games. And I'm like, all right, Republican Congressional Committee, they obviously bought out all this. The Democrats aren't even playing on college football. That's interesting. And then I'm like, tapping Jen. She's made best friends with these women from Philadelphia who are like eyes glued on the Phillies versus Astros deciding game. But I'm just tapping Jen on the shoulder. It's like, oh, look, the Democrats bought heavily on the Vegas Golden Knights game.
And I'm just like, really?
Yeah. This is why I don't have friends.
I've been researching my options on the Texas ballot today, and it was very disheartening. It was very disheartening. I just, like so many of, like I haven't even, I'll say on the municipal level, I am heartened so far. I've only just started researching councilman issues.
Yeah.
But one of them, I won't say which, I found really irritating, but at least knew stuff about zoning. And I was like, that's the one I'm voting for.
Yeah.
I'm voting for that person that drops a lot of bullshit buzzwords, but wants to get rid of single family dwelling occupancy only zones. I'm voting for them. But outside of that one candidate, at the statewide issues, so many of them would be like, I'm running for the commissioner of dominoes. And here's why I believe in board games and veterans and I'm pro-life. And I'm like, what the fuck does this have to do with the thing you're then like? And then I looked at the court justices. None of them will tell you anything. They'd be like, yeah, justice is very important to me. And I'm like, yeah, okay. It was very, yeah. I was disheartened by the end of today.
Time is ticking. Have you made your decisions?
Pretty much. Yeah. I mean, I've kept a list of state and federal office. I mean, I'm only voting for one federal office this election, yeah, right? But state and federal offices, I've gone through there. I haven't gone through local mayoral council and referendums yet. I'm doing that this evening.
Well, we will see.
If you want to hear someone be disheartened, listen to this week's PX3.
Oh, yeah. No, the Patreon. So Jen came with me to the Adam Laxalt rally and mostly was horrified to find out, Eden, that political rally events are not catered.
Which we just went out to dinner and I had this same exact reaction. Yeah. I'm still pissed about it. Yeah. They should have had something for these poor sad sacks that went to the saddest parking lot. We were surrounded by big rigs. There was no toilets, no water. I mean, it was kind of unsafe at that level. Like these poor people, like these fucking politicians, they bring a giant bus. Which, you know, us peasants are not welcome to go and look at. It was just gross. The whole thing was, I've never been to a political rally before. And now I get why America hates them.
You were charmed by the press secretary, though. He was a nice guy, even though he called me a creep.
Charmed? I don't know if that's the word for it.
You said he gave you good vibes.
Yeah, he wasn't a smarmy weasel.
There we go.
That's the best I could say about anything that happened there is that that guy was not a smarmy weasel.
Tell you what, when I launch my Whig candidacy in 2024, we will have finger food, Jen Briney.
Good. Make it tacos. You got my vote.
Okay, we can do that. More tacos, and I will fix the printer. These are the two things I'm running on.
Catering.
This vice president catering. Wig candidate.
Not catering. Catering. Go to fucking Costco and get 20 cookies for the 20 people that showed up. Like, they might not even eat them, but just like show appreciation for these people that showed up to the parking lot. That's the thing that killed me. These people showed up to get yelled at in this parking lot. No handshakes, nothing. There was just... I don't understand the voter's role.
You know, when I was a kid, you got a hand job, you got all sorts of things you'd get.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Kid.
Phil Graham rallies were the tits. They were great.
They called Jimmy Carter old dual hand, the way he would work the rope line.
Wait, how many people were at this event?
Like 100.
100 to 125, I would say.
We're talking $10 in cookies. Like, it did not have to be a lot to just be like, we appreciate you being here.
This is a ridiculous take. I do love the fact that it's the hill that you're going to die on, is that they need food at every political rally.
No, it's just emblematic of like the entire vibe of the whole thing. Even with Cortez Masto, you go on the website and it is, what can you do for me, voter? But we are supposed to be voting for these people to represent us. I just didn't get this vibe that the people that were there were in any way appreciated. I felt like they were tools of the campaign.
I will say that your reaction to being at a political rally was instructive for me to just say like, okay, well, if somebody is having this reaction, then maybe thinking about a more friendly way to do it as opposed to what it is now, which is effectively just a logistics game. You are stripping it down to as fast as you can get from one rally to another rally to another rally, or as Catherine Cortez Masto is doing it, not doing any rallies at all, which now it's Monday night. Mayor Pete was supposed to be there in Nevada, so he didn't even show up today. That's what we thought we were going. That was going to be her big event that she was going to do over the weekend, because that was the reporting that was out there on Friday. Not so much. So she just didn't do any rallies at all. Whatsoever.
But she did have a long list of opportunities where the voters could work for her.
To go door knock.
Yeah. I, for one, think we should give more money and power to these people. By the way, maybe when we give them more control over our lives, they'll provide us finger sandwiches.
Here's hoping. Yeah, and you want to know what? Now I'm totally on your side again. I think the last time we had this conversation, I wound up on your side too. Races for Georgia, Pennsylvania, Nevada, and Arizona. If you include the $50 million spent on the Pennsylvania primary, which was hotly contested, those four states alone accounted for $1 billion spent to wrangle those four Senate seats.
That's insane. It's such a waste of resources.
Well.
And it could purchase so many tacos. That's my point.
Maybe. We could fund it if we had $1.9 billion. That, according to when we are recording this podcast on Monday night, is the Powerball's world record jackpot after no one matched all six numbers on Saturday's drawing. The cash option for Monday, November 7th drawing is now at an estimated $929.1 million. And Powerball officials say that this is the largest lottery prize in Powerball history. August 3rd was the last time a Powerball jackpot was won, and the jackpot has rolled over 40 times since then. Lottery officials said that the only other Powerball jackpot to reach 41 consecutive drawings without a grand prize winner ended on October 4th, 2021, when a ticket sold in California for $699.8 million. Drew Svitko, the Powerball product group chair and Pennsylvania lottery executive, said, like the rest of America and the world, I think we're all eager to find out when this historic jackpot will eventually be won. As the excitement continues, we would like to remind players that Powerball was designed to be a fun and relatively inexpensive form of entertainment. Please know the odds and play within your limits. It only takes one ticket to win. Jen, is lottery indeed a moral fun wager, or is it exploitation of the poorest Americans?
I actually think the lottery is kind of fun. I don't, people outside of Massachusetts, I don't know if they're aware of this, but like the lottery and just gambling in general is a big part of the culture there. And so we're like, my whole family is from there. Like I remember, you know, my aunt and uncle, you know, they would have their scratchers. You play your numbers. And it was just, it was a fun thing. And if there was a big, you know, like a Powerball is going to hit a billion, everyone got a couple tickets, you check your numbers and everyone loses. But there was that little piece of hope and everyone was involved in it. I don't know if it's true, but like the rumor was that the money went to pay for education or some shit. And if that's actually true, then like, I find it relatively harmless because it's all voluntary. So just like going to Vegas and I bet on football games, you played the slots, like we're making our choices to kind of fuck with our money and hope that we get some back. I don't see how the lottery is any different from that. And if dumb people get too into it and lose their money, like that's what personal responsibility is all about. So I find it relatively harmless and I have no problem with it.
So
now
you
tell
don't,
me why
you don't,
I'm immoral.
You know, well, so you don't find it, the fact that it's government sanctioned or anything like that. You don't find that, that crosses any kind of line.
No.
Okay. I can weigh in there. I agree with you about the concept of the lottery, but the government running it is the problem I have with it. So I buy lottery tickets probably 4 or 5 times a year for the same reasons you bring out. And every, like, by the way, people go, the economics of it's horrible because you're not, you know, it's 1 in 300 million. I'm paying $1 to fantasize about being rich. It is ticket to admission. So I like lottery tickets. I enjoy them. However, I think using them as a funding mechanism for the state is immoral and exploitative. It's one thing for casinos to operate or for a casino or some other private group to have a lottery for all the reasons that you brought up. It's voluntary. It's okay if people want to do that. However, when you look at a lottery that's run by the government, which it's my understanding that it's a series of state agencies that are compendiums within the lottery system, and it's meant to pay out to education.
I believe every state is different on the specifics of it, but in general, nothing happens unless the state is wetting their beak on it.
The problem that I have with that is it is disproportionately funded by poor people. Like I think it's some Powerball tickets are in the ballpark. 40% of Powerball tickets are purchased by people that have less than $400 of money in the event of an emergency. Like people in the bottom quintile pay for about half the Powerball tickets and they'll spend hundreds of dollars on them every year. I think the government funding itself by preying on the hopes of desperate poor people is immoral. I don't think that's how the government should fund itself. I am very much opposed to any type of regressive taxation. I think sales taxes, your license on your car, not your licensing card, the tag on your car. These are all things that end up disproportionately hurting poor people. And, having the state try to prey on people in order to fund itself to me is immoral. I would much rather come up with other funding mechanisms. And if the private sector wants to do lotteries, that's fine, but I don't want the government funding itself.
Well, I just find that really interesting because if the money is going into the state and the state's then paying for public education, you can argue that money is making a full circle loop and still benefiting those people just because like they spend money on the lottery ticket, that dollar goes there, they don't win, but then the dollar goes into their kids' public school. Like it's kind of a full loop. If you have the private sector doing this lottery, then that's a one-way dollar. It goes to that company and then that company profits and it's just gone. So at least where it's the government, it does come back into the community, which you have to like most of the benefits go through welfare, education, that type of stuff. So if it comes back to them in that way, I see it as way less predatory than if you had a private company taking it and profiting.
Can I give you another example?
Sure.
Let's say that the government is going to fund itself by selling cigarettes to poor people. Now the proceeds from those cigarettes they're selling to poor people are going to go to education. Is that something you want the government doing?
We do tax cigarettes and alcohol, and then we do put that back into
not taxing it, selling it. Like the government going out and going like, hey, would you like to buy some cigarettes? And we're going to have some money off of it.
I don't think it's a fair comparison because it's not physically hurting anyone.
Well, here, let's take it out of the realm of metaphors, although somebody is probably going to email us about exactly how this works. But Pennsylvania has package stores that are government operated. Like you need to buy alcohol from stores that are operated by the government.
In the case of Pennsylvania, though, this is going to be a weird way for me to swing for what is in effect a Soviet liquor store. The reason that Pennsylvania has a government run liquor agency is not in order to get revenue for the state. It's in order to discourage people from drinking because the good people of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania realized the best way to discourage somebody from doing something was to have the government run it in the private sector. So they designed that particular store in Pennsylvania run by the Pennsylvania government, knowing that it would be irritating and onerous for people to purchase liquor at, and hoping that they would quit buying liquor.
So it was like a temperance act designed by Ron Swanson?
Basically, yes. It came after Prohibition was repealed, and they went, oh, we can't stop people from buying liquor anymore. We'll make it really irritating for them by having an unwieldy government agency do it instead of the private sector. So it's actually doing what it was designed to do. Like they
But it doesn't gather the revenue then? The revenue doesn't go back to the coffers? I think
they get the revenue for it, but they didn't design it in order to get revenue. They designed it in order to impede drinking.
But the idea of government funding through vice.
Yeah, well, that's the other thing too. We've not talked about sin taxes yet, but this kind of is like a voluntary sin tax because it's gambling. Sin taxes are incredibly regressive. And they're really popular with.
Are you saying sin, like S-I-N?
Yeah, sin. Taxes? So sin taxes are like alcohol and tobacco taxes, and they're really regressive. The politicians really like them because it's very difficult to raise property taxes or to raise income taxes. The people that you're actually going to get the money from are affluent and able to combat you and get you knocked out and are very powerful. The people that aren't powerful are poor people. And when you have tobacco taxes, alcohol taxes, it ends up being a way to just sort of shift the tax burden over to poor people that are bad at organizing and then kind of act as if it's a moral thing. But in reality, it's abandoning the funding mechanisms and sloughing them over onto poor folks. So like I would get rid of all sin taxes.
Again, I just can't stop thinking about the loop. Like, I'd rather the money come back into the community than go to some rich guy's pocket.
Providing that the loop works.
Well, I mean, public schools exist and are funded, and I think
and they're great. Everybody loves them, Justin.
I went to a great public school. I had no problem with my public school system, and I feel like the public school would be better if we didn't have one of our political parties hell bent on privatizing it and starting this charter school bullshit. And like, we could have a great public school system if we prioritized it, and we don't. And I think that if we took away the lottery money, it only gets even worse. So
it is a lack of funding that makes people dissatisfied with public schools.
I'm sure there's a bunch of stuff,
but this is a whole nother topic.
This is a whole other topic. I'm going to refrain. I don't know how the funding mechanism works on a state by state basis. But my suspicion is that they don't take the money and like pipeline it into underperforming inner city school districts.
They don't. So it's like the public schools, like I was raised in a fairly wealthy community in Orange County. Our public schools were great. Newport Beach public schools are great.
From the lottery tax specifically, I mean.
Oh, I have no idea. And that's the thing. It's state by state. So I can,
I
know a little bit about Massachusetts and California. So I don't know anything about.
Theoretically, we are entirely theoretical here because I do not know. But theoretically, let's say in Kentucky that about half of the lottery tickets half the proceeds are coming from people below the poverty threshold. That money all goes into a collective pile and then is divvied out across the whole state, regardless of income level. So affluent suburbs are getting that poor people money. And it's basically redistributing up from the poor to the wealthy. Would that bother you?
Well, that's something that we can change. Like if that is in fact the case, then you can say that it has to go based on the percent. Like if 50% of the money came from a low income community, you can say that has to go back into the communities at a equal proportion or something like that. I mean, there's things we can do that aren't privatize the lottery and have none of that money go back into those communities. They end up in shareholders' pockets, and that doesn't help these poor people because they're going to buy the lottery tickets no matter what. Unless you just get rid of the lottery, they're buying the tickets. The question is, where does their dollar go? And I prefer it go back into their kids' school.
I would recommend everybody go play the Dragon versus Panda slot machine in the Excalibur Resort in Las Vegas, Nevada, because I hit a lick for $150. Here's the thing. When you get three little tokens and one of them says versus, the panda fights the dragon and you have to choose whether or not you're on the team dragon or team panda side. I went with the dragon first. Bupkis. And then I picked the panda and holy shit, did that fuzzy son of a bitch deliver a windfall into my pocket. Gambling's great and it never goes wrong.
And both of us won money on this trip.
We did. We did. I don't know if I won money overall, but I won money last night, which was really fun.
Yeah.
We'renotwrongpod@gmail.com is where you need to write the show. We'renotwrongpod@gmail.com. Get it tattooed on your face like Post Malone. We'renotwrongpod@gmail.com. Not all heroes wear capes, right? I was inspired by you three to take a considerable time to research my entire ballot and watch every single Georgia debate. Good for you.
Good for you, listener.
I'm very proud.
I watched one Georgia debate and that was enough for me. So you are more of a sicko for that stuff than even I am. And that's saying something.
But you're an informed voter and we approve.
We approve. Captain Unintended Consequences writes, if you want to view a successful failed antitrust case, look no further than the 1983 Bell breakup. Ma Bell was broken into several local companies and a long distance company, as well as others. Later mergers started, and now we have several large corporations again. Just look to that whenever anybody is talking about antitrust.
Well, that's kind of the entire point, that since the 1980s, antitrust hasn't been enforced and these companies have been able to re-merge. That's not a failed breakup of a company. It's just that we've stopped doing those things. And now we have these massive companies again. I don't think that's a failure of what happened in the 80s. I guess it's a failure of what happened ever since.
I was a bit thrown off by the email. The phrase was a successful failed.
So I didn't know what that meant. A successful breakup. So AT&T, you know, was broken up.
Into the baby bells,
all the regional stuff. And then was it MCI? Was that the long distance one? Anyway, but now they have all essentially kind of reformed into.
And it's actually gotten a lot worse. So I did an episode about this. After 9/11, we found out, you know, like our firefighters and our police couldn't communicate. And so we decided that we needed a nationwide emergency communication network so that, you know, if you have firefighters coming in from another state or whatever, they can all get onto this one channel and be able to speak to each other. It's a really good idea. Passes into law, like not that long after 9/11. And then fucking nothing happens and they don't create it. So now, based on that law, what we have is something called FirstNet, which is our emergency responder network, which is operated by AT&T. So instead of AT&T just being too big to fail, it is now too intertwined with our government to fail because it's literally our emergency communications network. So I actually think we're in a worse place now than we were in the 1980s, because even the stuff that's technically public is now wholly owned by private companies.
I want to make a call to listeners. If we should return to this issue of antitrust, I reiterate my position that competition is good. And so I see a role for antitrust. I haven't had anybody yet tell me, like, this is the market share level where things go to shit. If that exists, if somebody knows of, yes, economists have determined that if you have 40% of the market, that's when things go to hell. Please send it to me, as I would love to read that. That way I can start like building that into my model.
Have you read any of Matt Stoller's books?
No.
You should, because he's the one that really taught me about a lot of this. He did Goliath, and I think Monopolized was it. I know Goliath was his, but he makes those arguments. He has those numbers. I definitely don't know them off the top of my head, but I think if those are the questions you're asking, that's where I would go.
There is also a larger question of what is a market in a world where the internet democratized a lot of platforms. Like you used to be able to say with the phone companies, for example, of like, okay, well you own X amount of poles, you own X amount of wiring that goes through stuff. And you can still see that with like a physical delivery of internet, which has now become the realm of the telcos as well. But in a lot of industries where everything is kind of delivered over the web, the question then becomes exactly what are you competing with? Like what is exactly your market?
Well, I just know that when I lived in Boston, I had the choice of exactly one company to get my phone and internet from, and it was Comcast. And it was a big deal when Verizon Fios came in and started competing with them. And the prices
went down fast because that's what usually happens with telco stuff.
Well, if you were blessed enough to live in a place where Verizon was allowed to hook up, there was price competition. It was very obvious. And Verizon Fios was the best. I loved it. But our congressman actually at the time was a guy named John Capuano, and he was well known for being in the bag for Comcast. And so if you were in his district, you just couldn't fucking get Verizon Fios until he left. And so if you have a situation like that, where I am just a captured customer, like I live on the internet, I cannot do my job without it. So I had to pay whatever Comcast said I had to pay. That's where it becomes a problem.
To be clear, 100% is a monopoly. And I don't disagree that 100% market share monopoly is going to be anti-competitive. And in a situation like that, I do want the government to facilitate competition.
And so I think those are the low hanging fruit. Like right. we know that exists in certain industries and certain locations. So let's take care of that first, because we're all going to agree on that.
Yeah.
And then we can go from there. But where we have zero choices as customers, like let's start there.
Sure. Okay.
An actual employee at SpaceX writes, cool it a little bit on the we should be on Mars by now stuff, question mark. We're working on it. And we're making progress. I dare you to name another entity, government or otherwise, that's making a fifth of as much as we are, as fast as we are.
Someone missed the point. The point was that your boss is doing a lot of really important societal things. The truth is, I don't give a fuck if we go to Mars. I care about this planet, not really colonizing another one for all the rich people to go to. So good luck with your mission, but I don't care that it's not done.
I want to live on Mars with the rich people. That's not true. I do want to have a Mars base, and I would love to have a lunar base. Hey, I think SpaceX is doing really cool shit. I just think that there's more fun things for Musk to spend his money on than Twitter. But yeah, SpaceX gets a thumbs up from me.
An important question writes, why does Matt Welch from Reason want to knife Andrew Heaton? Why has he tried to do so on multiple occasions? And most importantly, how can we arrange for this to be settled on pay-per-view? What is your beef with Matt Welch? Yeah,
you have an enemy?
That, you know, Matt Welch, the amount of times that man has threatened to kill me.
Has he pulled a blade on you?
Yeah, he's pulled a blade on me all the time. I bring it up whenever I go to parties at his place in New York City. I, for one, think that Matt should call me out on his very popular, successful program, The Fifth Column.
Well, and, no, you should call him out now so he answers your call on his. That's the way. We got to beef up, Heaton.
Yes, yes. Well, let me just say this.
Yeah.
Let me just say this about myself and my two colleagues here. Jen and Justin, for all of the umbrage we sometimes have, none of them, unlike Matt, have taken billions of dollars of blood diamond money. And Matt wants to come after me to disclaim this blood diamond money thing that I've brought up, then so be it.
You know, it's very interesting because as a listener to the Reason Roundtable podcast, I've never heard him once deny that he has taken blood diamond money.
Yeah, right.
Telling.
See? Yeah.
Telling.
Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. Space Solar writes, I would encourage you guys to look into the research that Caltech has done to develop space-based solar power using the $100 million grant they got from Daniel Brennan in 2013. It's extremely innovative research that may make space-based solar power economically competitive with modern fossil fuels at the current cost of launch, and even more so with the potential of a 10 times reduction in launch costs that is likely once SpaceX's Starship goes online.
Wife of a solar power engineer sitting here. Solar power here on Earth is already competitive with fossil fuels. Let's just do solar power here on Earth. We don't need to do everything in space, because just doing it in space, I know SpaceX has fun rockets that'll send your panels up there, but we're doing just fine with tech here on Earth. Like, let's just invest in that. Jesus fucking Christ. It doesn't have to be this hard.
I'm not married to a solar power engineer, but I've slept with a bunch.
He's made quite a few walk of shames.
Yeah, I'm very excited about this development. I know what you're talking about.
What?
I did an episode with Lori Garver about 6 months ago, who's the former number two from NASA. And the accompanying bonus episode for that on the political orphanage was about just interesting developments happening in space enterprise. And that was one of the first things that came up. Somebody gave a massive amount of money to Caltech, and Caltech basically developed a type of solar panel that's in space that doesn't have to deal with, bad weather and things like that. It's above the cloud line and it's more efficient because there's no atmosphere there. And they developed it to be economically worthwhile based on the payload prices of the day they started, which was like 10 years ago. Now it's nothing. It's dramatically dropped. So the ability to potentially make solar energy mind-bogglingly cheap is incredible there. However, this is where smarter people than me can weigh in. They would beam it back down via microwave. I am told that there's no way that could go wrong and that the microwaves are not harmful, but that seems to me like it would turn into a Bond villain movie real quick too. So I'd like a little bit further confirmation on my end. That said, some really cool stuff's gone on over there.
There is this magical thing. It's like a giant ball of fire. It's known as the sun, and it is already beaming its beams all the way here to Earth. And we have these panels that can collect the beams that are already hitting. And then we can connect those wires to our house.
Why do you see this as an adversarial thing and not another thing that would benefit your cause?
It's ridiculous. That's why. Because, like, I know how hard it is. Like, when I'm listening to my husband's calls, it's all about transmission lines and how you get the power to be what it needs to be and where it needs to go. And so now we're going to beam it in from space. Like you said, nothing's going to go wrong with that. Like, we have the technology. That's why I get so annoyed with this. We have the technology to solve the problems that we have in a much shorter time scale than trying to figure out solar panel from space.
I don't think that this guy is saying that one should happen and not the other, though.
But if we're going to be spending the money and making these investments, I just think that that is a bit of a distraction from what we already have. What we need to do is figure out battery power. And here on Earth, we have what we need on Earth. That's why I get annoyed at that.
Stop dreaming. Stop dreaming of cool things. Everything, we have McDonald's at home. It's the same.
I think that you all raised on Star Wars and Star Trek and all this star shit, and you want it to be real. Stop it. We have what we need right here. Just stop it.
I mean, if it is much more efficient, isn't that worth looking into?
What wire can you connect to that fucking panel to get it to make your toaster toast your bread?
Don't know. But if it were, you know, if it were safe and they were able to make it really efficient and not have cloudy weather affected, that'd be worth looking
into. Here's the thing. The problem isn't that we're not getting the sunbeams to Earth. The sun is taking care of that part for us. What we need is to be able to harness it, store it, and use it here in our homes. That's the problem that needs to be solved. The sun is already doing the job that NASA right now is spending our money to figure out. Like, the beams are coming. So then
by and large, you're for it.
Fuck.
Football Man writes, as a fellow New England Patriots fan, I wish that, Jen, you would spend more time reminding Justin that the Steelers and their stupid yellow towels are a second-class organization compared to the New England Patriots. Tom Brady is forever their daddy, and Roethlisberger stinks. I would like to respond to that by saying, indeed, the Patriots organization and the Kraft family have created an exemplary organization. You can't argue with success. And I, for one, would like to give him a hand job. Oh, yep. No, wait. That's what he likes to do in the Palm Beach Jack houses that he got busted by the fucking cops for. Tom Brady, good, nice enough guy. I was glad to see that he was able to get a win after his second failed marriage, one of which where he abandoned a child. But I do want to point out that it was at Kraft's wedding that he had on a Friday during football season that Tom Brady went to. And then who did he lose to? A very, very, very below average Pittsburgh Steelers team a few weeks ago. Moving on.
Jen, he just got the reaction that he was looking for. That.
wait, yeah.
And by the way, he's only been married once. He was just fucking around with Bridget Moynihan.
Gotcha. Okay. Second failed relationship.
Who are the teams you're rooting for?
Second failed relationship.
You're rooting for who?
Patriots. And then he's into the Steelers. I like their stupid Pittsburgh fucking Steelers. Towels.
Hey, Justin, I put them on those towels. You know what would really help the Steelers?
What's
if
that?
If they had a decent pitcher?
Oh, God, Andrew. Move on, please.
And finally, a Vegas historian writes, Mr. Heaton, you might be interested to know that Vegas wasn't founded on cum and casinos. That came later. I don't know if he meant to do that as a pun. It started as a fort built by the Latter-day Saints as a stopping point for supplies between Salt Lake cities and Los Angeles.
Well, the world is a little bit less glittery and fun. thanks for telling me that Las Vegas is genetically the Branson, Missouri of Mormons. That's delightful to know.
That's it. We were there this weekend. It was the professional bull riding finals. So a lot of folks in camo jackets and cowboy hats. And Jen was remarking as to how many of them were there on the strip. And I'm like, well, just you got to remember, it belonged to the shit kickers before it long belonged to dazzling urbanites like us. Like before a sport jacket was ever seen in that town, it had been drowned in fringe.
Here's a hot take I've got on rodeos and bull riding.
What's that?
I think that the whole paradigm screwed up. Because it's like, oh, that guy sat on the bull a really long time. The bull always wins. There should be a counter up on the thing that's like, bull won 8 times, humans 0 times. The only time you ever beat a bull riding, is if you ride it long enough that it lays down and lets you rub its tummy. And that never happens.
You should befriend the bull. That should be the ultimate goal. Like the greatest bullfighter at all times is a bull befriender.
I agree.
We're Not Wrong is a production of Dog and Pony Show Audio. Our editor is Will Saddleberg. What do we have? We're doing this on a short porch here because I got to leave right after the midterms and we're all hanging out on a midterm night. So I guess we can No, never mind. It will have already happened by the time that that this is released, our big PX3 thing. Although it'll be out. So you can listen to us reacting to the midterms on Politics, Politics, Politics. That will be released by the time that this is released.
And I think I'm going to take maybe the audio itself from the live stream. Like, I don't know. I'm going to see what happens tomorrow. But my next episode of Congressional Dish is going to be talking about who our new people are. I don't know. Some stuff about the midterms, what to expect coming up. But I'll be doing some kind of election special and definitely be using, if not the actual audio from the live stream, but the information that we get from it. Because I'm sure that Justin here is going to know more about the candidates.
And as the eyes of the world turn to the fate of the House and the Senate, I assume on the political orphanage that you'll be talking about Austrian funding for clowns.
Yeah, we'll be talking about Georgism. I don't know. I actually don't know what we're doing on the political orphanage this week. Probably something with the midterms, but I'd like to come up with some kind of insight that I can offer, because I feel like the punditry analysis of it will be more than handled by my friend Justin Robert Young. I'm not going to add anything beyond that. So I don't know what I'll do. I'll find some element that I can focus on.
Yeah, and I think I'll do something about the election, but it'll really be talking about the lame duck, because I don't really know what to expect until I know what the House and Senate makeup's going to be. So I'll be looking at the most dangerous time of the Congress.
Dead ceiling.
When a bunch of people that just got fired still have power for 2 months. What a great idea.
reporting today said codification of gay marriage
on
the docket.
Really?
It was about to happen before the midterms. And then they were like, well, it's the midterms. Let's not make
a lot of people happy.
Let's circle back. Yeah, no, because they don't need everybody to be happy. They need them to be angry.
You
got to
vote
us,
otherwise we won't be able to pass gay marriage.
Exactly. All right. That's about it for us. Until next time, I'm Justin Robert Young for Jen Briney and Andrew Heaton, and we're not wrong.
Dog and Pony Show Audio.